Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer, and I'm the director of Northwestern University's Infrastructure Technology Institute.
And I'm your co-host, Tom Herman.
The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it.
Two-thirds of the state of California's freshwater needs are supplied by the Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta in Northern California. Runoff flows into the delta from the Sierra Nevada Mountains, the Cascade Range, and the Pacific Coast Range. Until the 1800s, the delta flooded each year in the spring. But in the latter part of that century, levee construction was undertaken for flood control and to reclaim land for farming, which created one of the most productive agricultural areas in the nation.
Today, there are about 1,100 miles of levees in the Delta. Their condition is a major concern to the state of California because a failure could result in catastrophic flooding of the agricultural area and disruption of water supply to other parts of the state. Here to discuss with us this dilemma of how to ensure the safety of the Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta is Jeffrey Mount. Jeffrey is professor of geology at the University of California, Davis. Jeff, thanks so much for talking with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So educate us a little bit more about this levee system in the Delta. Where is it, what is it, and what is the condition?
Well, all of this lies at the head of San Francisco Bay. So the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta is really the far, far eastern edge of the San Francisco Bay at the confluence of the largest and the third largest river in California. And we call it a delta, but it's really a freshwater estuary. And historically, it was a 700,000-acre mosaic of tule marsh and rivers and riverine forests. So it was very large, very productive ecologically. And then reclamation began in the 1800s, right after the gold rush came in. In fact, it was part of the stimulation to feed the miners. And reclamation involved basically diking and draining all of these tule marshes that were in the delta. So in the early years, starting in the mid to late 1800s, they basically put up these dikes everywhere and drained it. But they were little dikes. It was no big deal. But it was the only way they could recapture that area for farming. So 95% of the wetlands were removed. The thousands of miles of channels that existed were basically reduced to about 500 miles of rock-lined channels that we have here today. So it was a complete transformation, and the instrument of transformation was levees. Now, here's the problem. The Army Corps of Engineers did not build those levees. Those levees were built by local landowners, number one, and number two, they evolved through time. We sort of think of levees as being built in a single event, but that wasn't the case here. The levees themselves were, you know, no more than a meter or two high. They were very, very small when this all started. But the land on the inside of the levees began lowering as the organic soils, these peat soils, began to oxidize. And as the land would lower through time, you developed essentially the equivalent of an arms race. As the land would lower, the water would try to rush in because of the difference in hydraulic head between the water in the channel and the interior of the island, requiring an ever bigger levee. So they built these levees, evolved through time in the sense that they just kept piling more stuff on them and it'd make them bigger and bigger through time. So that today, they're massive. Some of them are quite large. Because the interior of many of these islands are as much as 20 to 25 feet below sea level now, you have to have a pretty massive levee to keep the water out. So people are mistaken and they think that this was all built in one time. No, it was built over almost 100 years of levee evolution, if such a thing exists.
So this is really interesting because I did have this image that some magic force came in and systematically designed and built these levees, but it's really a kind of a ad hoc piecemeal construction as you describe it.
Yeah, in fact, in the beginning, it was purely driven by landowners. Individual landowners would have what they called a reclamation district. They would assess themselves. They would then build the levee. They would maintain the levee. There was no state, no federal involvement. Today, about a third of the 1,100 miles of levees are part of a federal flood control project So they have been upgraded to an extent, but two-thirds of them are still privately owned, still privately maintained, with minimal state oversight.
What I imagine when you describe the fact that each small area is taking care of its own without a central plan, and I think you described when it was time to get higher, you throw some stuff on top of it. The image that comes to mind is the potential, first of all, that the structures aren't going to be uniform, but that some of them might not be so well built.
It's both, actually. And here's the even sadder side of all of that. Well, first of all, so there's a great deal of variability. The levees down there are like snowflakes. No two are alike. They're all of different geometries and different foundations and different embankment materials. There are some basic standards that were set forward set up in the 1980s after they had just repeated levee failures, and the federal government finally said, we're not going to come in and help you guys out anymore unless you do at least some minimal standards. So there is some very basic minimal standards, and that's usually the height of the levee, the crown width, and the slopes, but really no standards on the embankment materials themselves and the foundations underneath them. And it's the foundations underneath these levees which tends to cause the geotechnical engineers to get worried. Well, it's actually both, the foundations under the levees and then the levee constructions themselves. So to be clear, we also have no idea. Meaning we don't have a systematic survey of these 1,100 miles of levees to tell you what they're made of and what they're sitting on top of.
And is it the case that if one of them was to fail somewhere, is the whole area at risk, or is it localized that if it fails in your area is the only one that gets flooded?
Well, so it depends. To visualize this, imagine something like the Netherlands in this case, where the land itself is reclaimed with levees. So you have these levees which have, in effect, created a series of channels, a network of channels. And in behind those levees, the land is subsided in some cases as much as 25 feet below sea level. So it's a big hole in the ground, but it's actually a series of holes in the ground, series of polders surrounded by these levees. One of the big fears in this place is the domino effect, that when one of the levees fails and then fills the island with water, that sets up a large wind fetch. So as the wind blows across the water, it creates these significant waves. It blows like heck down in this delta, by the way, as you might expect. So it blows hard, then the wind waves break down the one of the levees and attack the levees of the next island. We call them islands, but they're holes in the ground. So basically, that's the worry about a domino effect. We have only, in the 144 levee failures that have happened in this place, the domino effect has only happened a couple of times, and it's not likely to lead to widespread failure all over the place. It's usually confined to just one or at most two other islands.
So you just answered my next question, which is have they ever failed? So apparently that's something that people in that area have got some experience with.
Yeah. And to the credit of the landowners in that area, for the last 30 years, they really have been working pretty hard with some state support to try and reduce the failures. This came about because, you know, I'm not joking, there were 144 failures over the history of the Delta. That's a lot of failures. Because the engineering was completely substandard on these levees. But they have been steadily improving them, sort of incrementally making investments. So we haven't had, in the last 5 years, a significant failure. I will tell you, actually, I take that back. The last 8 years, we haven't had a major failure. In 2006, we came real close to multiple failures. We had one of those great winter storms that we get here, our hurricanes that we get here in California, and it about 10 of the islands came very, very close to failing in the Delta at that time. But since that time, things have been pretty quiet, pretty stable, and the landowners have been putting a lot of time and money into it.
And as I understand it, there are two different plans being proposed to improve the safety of the Delta, to bypass the levees with a canal through the Delta, or alternatively to keep the levees but strengthen them. Can you elaborate a little on those plans? Is that right?
Yes. You actually have just landed on what is the most contentious water resource issue in the West right now. This is a, you know, we contest everything about water in California, but this one is white hot these days. And 25 million people receive a portion of their drinking water from the Delta, 3 million acres of irrigated agriculture in the richest agricultural region in the country receive water from this estuary. But the good water comes in on the north, on the Sacramento River, and all these export pumps are located on the south because that's where the demand is to the south. So somehow you've got to draw all that fresh water across an estuary, which, when you think about it, is a pretty bad idea to be taking your water, having your primary water source coming from an estuary, but that's the way it evolved. So now we're into this recognition that what we have now, which is this fragile network of 1,100 miles of levees, if there is a major failure of these levees, and that would probably be due to an earthquake, we will knock out that water supply system for a minimum of 6 months to as much as 3 years. And if it's a three-year knockout, those are the many tens of billions of dollars of economic damage. So, and at the same time, we're seeing a really sharp decline in that ecosystem of the Delta itself. So several grand plans have emerged, and there's a joint federal and state effort called the Bay Delta Conservation Plan, which is moving forward now to try and come up with a way to deal with this. And you're right, it comes down to something as basic as diverting the good, clean, abundant water that comes in on the north side of the Delta and putting it in what is called an isolated facility, because people didn't want to call it a canal because it's laden with all kinds of political problems, and taking it around the Delta and delivering it to the export pumps, and therefore isolating the water supply function from the rest of the Delta. The current thinking today, and this is quite relevant to your show, is that they're going to make a massive tunnel instead. They want to burrow into the ground and go some 40 miles underground and transfer the water that direction.
But just to repeat so that I understand it, the notion of this diversion facility, whatever you choose to call it, is to draw off the water really north of the estuary. And take it around this vulnerable zone and deliver it as potable water to whatever demand sites there are to the south. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. And with it comes a cascade of technological, economic, and political issues, because we've never done anything in California at this kind of scale. Just the facility alone would cost $15 billion. To build this facility that would route water around. The ecosystem restoration estimates are on the order of $3.5 billion. So this is not chump change. This is big money. And then of course there's the major political fear within the Delta itself that basically you would turn it into a salty mess by diverting this water, all this water. In water, by the way, everybody exaggerates the issue, so one has to always view this with a grain of salt.
And you suggested, I think, that the word canal was a very charged word politically. Why is that so in the West?
Well, back in 1982, this is exactly what was going to happen. There was going to be a very large canal called the Peripheral Canal, which was going to take water out of the Sacramento River and route it around the Delta and deliver it to the pumps in the south. And this was during the rise of the environmental movement in California, when it was really becoming strong, number one. And number two, it was at the beginning of a cultural divide between Northern California and Southern California. And it turns out a coalition of environmental interests in Northern California, farm groups in sort of Central California, were able to rally to defeat this in a referendum. It was so awful. I mean, literally, the stories of this time, you know, your friendships ended, marriages ended, political careers ended. This was a complete disaster. So nobody liked to talk about the Peripheral Canal. So even if it was a canal today, they wouldn't call it a Peripheral Canal.
Give it another name.
It's kind of like Voldemort, from Harry Potter.
You're not supposed to say that name out loud.
Voldemort? Yes, he who shall not be named.
What's the advantage of a tunnel?
This is this is going to sound hysterical to your listeners. The reason is that to build a canal, you're going to have to condemn a lot of property to build it. That is, it's not state-owned property, so through eminent domain, you're going to have to take private property to build it. The interests in the Delta are very well organized, and they have put up tremendous resistance to this. And so they came to the conclusion that although it was more expensive, the need to get this done outweighed the greater expense, so they decided to build a tunnel instead.
It's really the same problem that we have in building a transit system in a big city, that in order to avoid taking property, we go under the property.
Correct. And that's exactly what they're doing.
So to carry that the next step, so that's, as you describe it, somewhat more expensive to do it that way, or a lot more expensive to do it that way. Is there a source of revenue to do it?
Right. And so in this case, if you use water in the Bay Area or the San Joaquin Valley or in Los Angeles, you're going to pay for that structure. This is not the taxpayers paying for it. Then this is going to come right out of your hide through an increase in your water rates. So this is not a taxpayer-funded process. The part that the taxpayers get on the hook for is the broader public benefit issues, such as the $3.5 billion of ecosystem restoration. So that would be paid for probably by the federal government and the state government.
The one thing that I want to go back to, though, is that I can envision this diversion facility, whether it's at the surface or below the surface, pulling off, if you will, the cleaner water and taking it around and protecting it from flooding. But without doing something to the levees, isn't the agricultural land still at risk for flooding?
Yes. So this is one of the big political concerns, that if the state and the federal government succeed in building this facility that routes water around the Delta, the state and federal government will lose interest in the levees in the Delta, and they'll just be allowed to crumble. And the farmers there who it does not make economic sense to maintain those levees solely for farming on a lot of the islands. That's not entirely true for lots of areas of the Delta are rich farming areas, and they're making plenty of money, and it justifies the expense of continuing to repair and upgrade these levees. But there are major portions, particularly in the parts that are deeply subsided, where it just makes no economic sense based on land values and assets on the land to put essentially $1 million to $2 million per mile just to do modest improvements to these levees. So just, again, if the landowner had to pay for it, he or she could not do it. And so there's a great worry on the part of the landowners that if this peripheral facility, this isolated facility, this tunnel, or we call it a punnel, actually, if this punnel is built, that there'll be no federal and state dollars to help them keep their levees together.
Did you say you call it a punnel?
Like a punnel. It's a joke because it's everybody doesn't want to talk about the peripheral canal, so it's the peripheral tunnel. We call it the punnel.
And it sounds from the way you're speaking about it that the decision's been made to go underground with it. Is that correct?
No. We are right in the midst of a genuine world-class hog wrestle on water issues here in California. And so the decision is being made this summer whether to move forward on this project or not.
And aside from the financial issues of which way you go with it, does one break more positively for the ecological considerations, whether it's underground or above ground?
No, it makes no difference.
What about the project as a whole? It sounds like it could be made into a net benefit, if I understood what you were saying.
That is the working concept is by separating the water supply function from ecosystem management. You are actually going to do a better job of managing the ecosystem. Right now, one of the big problems we have is because you're exporting somewhere around 5 to as much as 6 million acre feet of water per year out of the Delta at its south end, you actually have completely changed the hydrodynamics of this estuary. And the native species that have evolved there and basically all their life history needs are cued by the flows and the temperatures in this estuary. Well, all of that's just turned upside down with the amount of export that's going on in these southern facilities. So that is one of the reasons, but it's one of probably a dozen reasons that the native species are in a crisis. I mean, they're serious in a very steep decline. So the idea is, and that decline directly affects the export of water, because you have the federal government under the Endangered Species Act and the state government under its own Endangered Species Act continuously to tighten down on the amount of exports that are coming out of the Delta because of the changes in environmental conditions. So the concept is, by taking the water out farther upstream, you restore sort of natural estuarine conditions in the Delta, aiding, along with a whole lot of other stuff that needs to be done, aiding the recovery of these native fishes.
I don't know if it's fair for me to ask you this question, but as a scientist, you find that a credible proposition?
It's a working hypothesis.
I see. Okay, I accept that as a really good, smart answer. So I have another perhaps naive question. It's hard for me, sitting 1,500 miles away, to understand who's really in charge.
Oh, wait a minute. You're not alone. I can't tell you who's in charge.
Oh.
Let me give you an example. In this delta, there are no less than 200 different federal, state, and local agencies with some sort of jurisdiction over this problem. I actually did a recent survey of who's doing science in this, because science is incredibly important in this. I got 100 different science organizations, meaning university, state, and federal, and private contractors, who are actively doing science. It is, I can only describe it jokingly, of course, as an adhocracy. Everybody's in charge and nobody's in charge, and that is part, you've identified one of the fundamental problems.
So you mentioned the decision's going to be made this summer. Who's the one that's going to make it?
Well, right now, basically, Governor Brown and his folks and his resources agency and the federal government, particularly through the Department of Interior, are engaged in negotiations on basically what they're willing to write a permit for. Then they have to take that to the people who would be regulated by this, and these are the people who buy the water from the Delta, and say, can you live with this? So that's the process that's going on this summer. And if that goes through, then they've already started the EIRs and all the rest of the sort of necessary administrative work on all this, but they haven't actually decided what the project is. So that's the decision that has to be made this summer.
And when you say it has to be made, are you optimistic that it will be made?
Well, that's a really, really good question. It depends on the day you ask me. Today, I give it a 50-50 chance.
Is that a good score?
That's a good score.
Okay.
Yeah, 50-50 is a good. Other days, I despair.
Well, this is a really interesting, complicated problem, a lot more complicated than we imagined when we started. It'll be interesting to watch. So the big vulnerability, I was thinking it was an earthquake or seismic risk, but it sounds like it's storm risk.
You know this quite well. I mean, when you're looking at risk in this system, you have compounded risks. So you've got the case of sea level rise, and it's rising here roughly 2 to 3 millimeters per year, and most predictions are it'll rise faster. And it isn't the sea level rise that's the issue; it's really the extreme tides that come with it. So you got sea level rise trying to work on filling all these holes in the ground. You have changing inflows here, as you are probably aware. We are changing our rain snow mix here in the Sierra Nevada,
yes.
And we're getting much more flow in the winter than in the spring. So we're seeing an increase in winter inflows. So that's a high flood risk. So it's tides, floods, and earthquakes. So those three together, that's a compounded risk. And when you do the statistics on this, it's pretty scary numbers. I mean, with probabilities of failure of these islands through the roof when you look out over the next 50 years.
That's quite a big collection of risks, particularly when we consider what other parts of the country are experiencing. But the change in climate, sounds to me, is a significant part of this looking forward.
Yes. I think this is what actually brought some urgency to the whole water supply side of this, is that when about 6 or 7 years ago, when the whole scientific community kind of sat down and said, look, you got to look at these risks here in aggregate rather than trying to look at them individually. You know, yes, you can mitigate for sea level rise. Yes, you can mitigate for increasing flood frequency, magnitude, and duration. You know, yes, you can mitigate for subsidence of your islands. And yes, you can mitigate for earthquakes. But you probably can't mitigate for all of these things at the same time very easily. So that was the, I think that you know, and then superimposed on top of that, the decline in the ecosystem itself. And then they said, yeah, this is a pretty complicated big problem. We probably should start thinking about it in a much bigger way rather than just trying to pick off one part of it at a time.
It certainly is a complicated problem. When we start out thinking in this podcast about infrastructure and technology problems, but you mix the issue of environment, natural risk, serious equity concerns, and the political process, it becomes particularly interesting. You know, we really appreciate your shedding some tremendously valuable light on this complicated problem for us. I'm not sure if we can do it, but from a distance, we'll watch what's going on. And as things develop, we might give you a call back and measure the progress.
Yeah, I'd welcome it.
Thank you. I'm glad to talk to you today.